Oh, headphones.
Is this what? Oh,
Oh.
the recording is what makes it laggy. Devastating.
Devastating.
Kinsey,
Hi.
how are you?
How are
Yep, doing
Sorry, it's
good.
taken so long to get to this actual meeting with you guys. Point.
No,
Whatever
that's okay. Thanks
it
for doing it. That it
Yeah.
actually worked out this time.
It sounds like a really great project. I'm happy to do it.
Well, yeah, I'm Sophia. So nice to meet you.
Nice to
I'm
meet
Sadie.
you.
Then we're both undergrads. I'm a junior in biology.
Okay.
And then I'm a senior in operations and supply chain and information systems.
Okay, cool.
And we have a third group member, Nate, but he might be able to join us a little bit later.
Okay.
He's on a research trip currently.
Sounds good.
And then we are like just recording it. We will just upload that so it'll be in the archives if that works for you. We know we sent that in an email just to make sure.
That's okay.
And then we have just like a form that we'll send over as well that's just like a release that you'll have your transcript on the website and then the records. That works. Perfect. You have any questions before we dive into questions about you?
No, we can dive in.
Okay, sweet. So I guess we're just going to start off just like with a little bit of your like early life background. So where did you grow up, and then how did this influence your future in the outdoors?
Yeah, so I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, and I spent a lot of time outside. My parents raised us skiing and biking and just spending a lot of time outside. And over sort of the time frame of growing up, I saw changes happening sort of in the natural environment around me in Alaska that you usually wouldn't be able to see over the course of a lifetime, just glaciers receding, permafrost melting, less snow in town every winter. And so when I was thinking about what I wanted to study, climate change was really my like first choice. And I picked the University of Utah. I mean, mostly because it was close to the mountains, so I could also ski. But then once I picked the University of Utah for my undergrad, I was able to sort of explore, how I could, like, within a very broad field of climate change, like what would I end up doing with that, or how would I focus that?
And then, so obviously, like you said, you always like you were influenced by just watching the climate change. Is there anything else you wanted to be like when you were a little kid, or was it always that kind of oriented?
Yeah, I think I had, I think like all like many kids, I had different ideas over time, sort of just depending on various interests. I think at some point I thought I wanted to be a doctor, and that didn't last for very long. I think I always knew. I think since I did some science projects in junior high that just were really interesting to me, more interesting than a lot of other things, and that I sort of narrowed in and knew I wanted to do something around science for sure. And so that it was always sort of within the broader field of science, and then it kind of got more and more specific over time.
Did your parents have any influence on a STEM specific career?
Oh, that's a good question. My dad was a math teacher, and always kind of just we played with a lot of puzzles, and he always just asked us lots of questions about sort of what we were thinking and helped us like sort of explain what we were thinking about. And so I think his way of fostering our curiosity about the world and making us think a little bit more about it probably had a lot to do with me going into an environmental science field.
So along with that, sounds like your dad was pretty supportive of you exploring these, but did you have any other family support or lack of any support in your, on your way to your career?
That's a good question. Sort of emotionally, they were all very supportive, but I come from a big family. There's six kids, and my parents never really had very much money. So I knew that if I was going to go to college, I was going to have to pay for it myself. And so financial support is always, you know, a big part of whether or not you go on to higher education. And so that was, you know, one challenge that I had to figure out how to overcome. But generally, my family and parents were always really supportive, even if they didn't fully understand always what I was studying. They were supportive.
Did you end up being one of the few to, or like how many of your siblings went to college?
There of six, four of us have gone to college, and two have gone on to, my brother's a lawyer and my sister is a community college professor. And then I have a younger sister who is doing her master's right now. So of the four of us that went on to higher education, we all have done some level of graduate school.
Did you have any specific like female scientists that you admired while growing up? And did they have any effect on you if you did have any?
Oh, that's such a good question. And the answer is no, I didn't. I always kind of felt like I was forging my own path and that it didn't really have many women, especially in the field that I'm in now in snow science, many women to look up to or interact with. And when I got farther into graduate school, I kind of sought people out, and I did end up finding people. But when I was sort of still figuring out what I wanted to do and sort of going into graduate school, there weren't many women or many women that I was aware of.
Did like the lack of role models inspire you in any ways, or do you think it ever deterred you from STEM, or was it pretty neutral?
Deterred me. I mean, luckily I mentioned my dad. I think I'm very fortunate to have a dad that made me feel like, or it just like was never brought up the fact of like, you can't do something because you're a woman. He's like, basically you can do anything you want to do. And that was really helpful, but I definitely had teachers in high school and even in college that kind of, you know, they would make assumptions about how far you would go in school or in your education. And they would say things offhand like, oh, you know, maybe you don't have to worry about that because you won't need it or in the future, like assuming you're not going to go into being a scientist. And so just offhand comments that sort of make you second guess if you're able to do something. But mostly I didn't really let it deter me. I mean, there definitely were those people and it would be disheartening, but I just kind of knew what I wanted to do and just kind of kept doing it.
That's about it for like the early part of your life questions. Do you have anything else to add? Any like stories or anything you think is notable that led you to this career or shaped you as a person? If not, that's totally okay as well.
No, I can tell a story, and it's funny because my first major at the University of Utah was actually biology, and I ended up switching to geography. And I had an advisor, an undergraduate advisor, just like, the person you go and ask to about classes. And I was, how do I say this? I was like, I was interested in biology, but I wasn't really that dedicated to it. And I also was at the University of Utah, and really liked to ski. So I kind of missed a lot of classes because I was skiing a lot. And my undergraduate advisor was basically told me that he didn't think I would make it in biology. Like he's like, I don't know if you're gonna do well in this department. And I look back on it now and it was like kind of rude and a little dismissive and not supportive at all. And I ended up like taking a geography class that I loved and moved over to that department and ended up doing really well. But like, I always think back on that and think like, how would have my like future have looked different if I had stayed in biology? But there's always sort of those forks in the road. I don't know if that had anything to do with me being female or not, or just he saw someone who skipped class every now and then. But so that was an interesting aspect that could have led to me doing something totally different with my life if I had stayed in biology.
It's okay. So, because kind of going into like undergrad and graduate school, you talked a little bit about why you chose the University of Utah. Did you choose the traditional 4-year path with biology and then like switching to geography, or was it different in any way than the traditional standard?
No, it was pretty traditional. I actually did the first year of undergraduate, and my first year of college was at the University of Hawaii. And then because I thought I wanted to surf. You don't know what you're like really wanted to do when you're 18. And then I switched to University of Utah because I missed the mountains and I missed the snow. And I had some family in Salt Lake. And then yeah, I did sort of the traditional path. Once I found geography, I double majored in geography and environmental studies. But it was pretty straight through 4 years of undergraduate.
When you were applying for universities, was the University of Utah your dream school, or did you apply to others that you had hoped to go into apart from University of Hawaii?
I did apply to some others, and now, of course, I am not going to remember where else I applied, but I think schools in Colorado and schools in Utah, and then I think some in the Pacific Northwest, and they were all somewhat close to mountains because just being able to get outside and go skiing or go trail running or go climbing was an important part of picking where I wanted to go to school.
Okay, and then I believe you did your master's at UCLA. What drove you to kind of apply there, and what made it stand out to you?
Yeah, so I did a master's at University of Utah in the geography department, and then I did my PhD at UCLA. And what drove me to go to UCLA was a couple of different things. One is I knew that potentially one day I wanted to come back to the University of Utah as a faculty if I could figure out a way to do that. And it's not typical to get hired as faculty at a university if you did your PhD there. So I kind of had in mind that I needed to go somewhere else to do my PhD if I wanted to ever come back to the University of Utah. And then another reason why I picked UCLA is I had an opportunity to get my PhD funded, and it's just a really great school. I wasn't super excited about living in LA for 4 years, but it was a great opportunity, and so I went for it.
Thank you. And then, did you participate in undergraduate research when you did your biology or sorry, geography degree at the University of Utah?
Yeah, I actually met my graduate advisor when I was an undergrad, and I knew that I was interested in snow, but I didn't actually know that that was like, I didn't know snow hydrology was a career that people had. And my graduate advisor was a brand new faculty member, went my senior year in undergraduate. And so I met him and he studied basically exactly what I wanted to study. And so I did do some undergraduate research with him that my senior year, and then went on to do my master's with him the following 2 years after I graduated from my undergraduate.
Then what do you think was the biggest challenge that you faced in undergrad?
You know, that's a good question. I don't want to say that there weren't any challenges, but I can't think of many. I enjoyed going to school, and being in the environmental studies and geography department. I sort of found that being in those programs gave me the exact tools that I needed to do like what I wanted to do in the future. And then of course, you know, Salt Lake is a great place to live, and I was skiing a lot, and it was so I don't I had an overall like pretty great undergraduate experience.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, that's pretty much the concludes the questions that we have for undergraduate.
So then we've already talked a little bit about your grad school and PhD. After you met your advisor, were you pretty set on doing your master's at the U, or did you look into anywhere else?
I did not look into anywhere else for my master's. He had a project idea that I really liked. And I guess before I met him, I had considered applying into other programs that weren't snow related. But once I found out that I could do a project around snow, I sort of just committed to that track, and didn't end up applying to graduate school anywhere else. By the time I decided to go to graduate school, the applications were due within a couple of weeks. And so I basically just like rushed to put it together and get it in time.
What did you do your project about for grad?
I did that. My master's project was focused on comparing the impacts of climate warming, so warming air temperatures, to the impacts of snow darkening or dust deposition on snow in a study area in the upper Colorado River Basin, so the San Juan Mountains in Colorado that now we know get dust deposition every year, but at the time this was a relatively new topic that hadn't really been well studied yet. And we didn't know really at the time what would be having a larger impact on snowmelt. Would it be increasing temperatures or this impact of darker snow from dust deposition? And so that was the focus of my master's research, was doing snowmelt modeling, looking at the relative impacts of dust and warming air temperatures, and then the two of them in combination and seeing what had a bigger impact on snowmelt.
With that, just like with all your project and everything you did for it, is there anything that stands out or that you want to share for your record?
Yeah, sure. The outcome of that paper was that dust and snow darkening had a much larger impact than warming air temperatures, which I think was surprising to many people, and maybe even surprising to myself, because I went in to graduate school and was like pretty insistent to my graduate advisor that I was studying climate change and that I was studying the impacts warming air temperatures on snow. And then this other, you know, topic sort of came up and it had such a, you know, a really big impact on snowmelt. And the way that my experiments were set up in that paper had ended up getting a lot of attention. I won a big award an Editor's Choice Award for the first peer-reviewed publication that I had ever published. And to give a lot of credit to my graduate advisor, because a lot of it he helped me like set up, but that was really exciting. And I think that award potentially motivated me to keep going in research. So I think, you know, recognition and support is like a big reason of why I decided to keep going in science.
What do you think was the biggest challenge you faced in grad school and or your PhD?
Oh, I think that I think being a woman in a male dominated field, it's gotten better over the last decade, but at the time, there were very few women in snow science and snow hydrology, and it wasn't my graduate advisor who was very supportive, but other people in the field that would just be dismissive, or like not assume that I would be able to do field work, or I wouldn't get invited to do field work. You know, because everyone else going would be male. And I feel like I've missed out on opportunities. And then also people just giving my graduate advisor credit for work that I had done, which I always found pretty frustrating, but he was very good at recognizing or pointing out that it had been research that I was done. So that aspect, I like to think that it's gotten better, but when I first started, it was pretty rough.
Just on a follow-up of those, do you think there's anything you had to like change about yourself to try to fit in the more male-dominated industry? And then, oh, no, actually, never know. I blanked on my second question. I'll come back.
I think so. I mean, I think that I think that a lot of people, especially when you're out of like a professional setting, and when you're, you know, even when you're doing field work, you're working, it's like not quite the same setting, and people tend to say things they maybe wouldn't say if they were like back in the office. And you know, men would just say really sort of dismissive and rude or even like offensive things, and I would just say like, or I would just pretend to ignore it or not hear it or pretend not to be offended, or I just would never say anything because I didn't want to rock the boat or be like difficult, especially when I had kind of forced my way into getting those experiences in the first place, that I didn't want, I guess I was just always afraid of being like, oh, it's like, why did she end up coming? Like, she's difficult, we're not going to invite women anymore or something like that. And you know, I think I probably should have spoke up sooner, because now that I'm more established, I'm not afraid to say something. But when you're in graduate school and you're new to everything, it can be really intimidating to bring it up.
On the other question I was going to ask is, did you feel, or did you see, I guess, other graduate students like yourself that were male that were getting the appropriate credit when you were stepped aside, or yeah, anything on that?
Yes. I feel like I always had to work, you know, maybe not twice as hard, but always had to work harder than male graduate students who are at the same level as me. Just had to present better, publish more, and still didn't feel like I got as much credit as male colleagues sort of at the same level or similar career stage as me. And honestly, that still happens. That's something that has not changed over time, which is really unfortunate, but it's kind of something that you get. It's a little sad to say this, like you just get used to it, like men getting more recognition than women in the field.
You mentioned earlier that you didn't really have, there wasn't anybody that inspired you when you were young as a woman, and that you said you kind of had to seek them out. Was there anybody in graduate school that was a female mentor to you or that you looked up to?
Yes. I had some amazing female mentors in graduate school, and a couple of them were doing collaborations with my graduate advisor, and then I got the chance to work with them, and then kind of just put in effort to keep working with them and maintain relationships with them, and get to a point where I felt comfortable enough to ask them for advice that wasn't necessarily didn't have anything to do with research necessarily, but just career advice or like how would you handle this situation? And so I was really fortunate to find a couple of strong female mentors during specifically my PhD that are still like mentors and friends today.
They give you any advice that still is like very key points that stick with you, or just generally a good presence in your life?
Yeah, one piece of advice that I still think about a lot is one of my mentors. She said, women are always expected to take on more service roles. So volunteer your time to lead a group, or even silly things like women are always asked to take notes in meetings if you're like the woman in the meeting. And she said, be selfish with your time. Don't take on these roles just because you're a woman. Like your science is just as important as everyone else's. And so don't let your time be taken up by these roles that people assume you should take on because you are a woman. And that has been really valuable because you sort of give yourself the freedom to say no to things that don't advance your career, and that men, male colleagues, don't feel like they have to take on. And so she just said, don't think about it any differently. Just say no if you don't want to do something.
I'm sorry if you can say something. Oh, no. Well, if you had another question. Is there, so as of it, having worked as a research assistant in graduate school, is there anything you've implemented like in your research today that is because of that?
That's a good question. Maybe not in my research directly, but just in my broader research program, I do try sort of some lessons that I have taken with me from stuff that I learned in graduate school. Well, is to now be supportive of my female colleagues to, sort of offer the same support that was offered to me, and to make sure that when I'm doing my research that I give recognition to female colleagues, and that, as one example, if you're writing a paper and citing other papers, what frequently happens is that male colleagues get their papers cited more often, and I just try to be very aware of if there's a female colleague who has done that work to cite them. And then if opportunities come up that would benefit them, to just loop them in and sort of just get a community of female snow scientists and snow hydrologists going up that can all support each other.
I guess kind of building on that, did you find a community either like in undergrad, graduate school, or in your research that was less of a mentor figure and more of like peer figures, like women who are also in STEM fields who are pursuing maybe similar research positions?
Yes, I think not less so during my graduate degree, but once I moved into my postdoctoral research, sort of the research that I did in between grad school and becoming faculty, I found women that were at the same sort of career stage as me, and that could have been, either working directly with them or at conferences. And that was also super helpful just to hear their experiences and how they were like the same or different than mine. And then just to watch how all of our careers have evolved and then make our field a more comfortable place for people that are, for women that are coming into the field after us, and being able to talk amongst ourselves and saying, look, how do we make new graduate students that are coming into this field feel more comfortable and supported? And luckily over time, more women have started coming into the field, of snow hydrology. And so I like to think it's made a difference. I don't, you know, it's hard to quantify, but, I think change is happening, even if it's a little slow.
More about your PhD, like at UCLA. Is there any, like why were you drawn to UCLA? And then like, what was the process like, and why was it your first choice? And if not, was it the right choice?
Yeah, great question. So my graduate advisor during my master's actually got a job, not at UCLA, but at NASA JPL. And he had funding for a research project, but you can't be a graduate student at NASA JPL because it's not a school. And so he said, you know, if you are willing to apply to UCLA, I have funding for a PhD project. And so that was an opportunity that I just couldn't pass up. It's to find a fully funded PhD as a research assistant can be challenging. And so I applied to UCLA, and my, you know, I had to have an advisor at UCLA, and there's a soil scientist, a soil and dust scientist there that ended up being my advisor. So I had a really unique experience where I was studying impacts of dust on snow and had two advisors, one who studied dust and one who studied snow. And that really was a unique opportunity. And I couldn't say no to it. It was just such a great opportunity. It was worth moving to UCLA. And then of course, UCLA is just a great school and has a great geography department. And that was a bonus, of course.
And then we talked about, or you mentioned how there's definitely a lot of exclusion when it came to like field work or getting credit for things. Is there any other times when you felt discouraged?
Well, I will say that graduate school is challenging. It takes a lot of time and you don't get paid very much money. And I mentioned previously that I don't come from a family with a lot of money. And so just, you know, getting discouraged, whether it be from, you know, feeling excluded or just the general challenges of doing graduate work and questioning whether or not I was making the right decision, because I just didn't have, I mean, I was just poor all the time, just didn't have very much money. And graduate school, they pay for your tuition and they pay you a little bit of money, but not very much. It's not enough to save. It's not really enough to, you know, to buy a house, or it's just kind of barely enough to get by. And you, it takes a long time. I finished my PhD at the end of my 20s. And you know, so it's a big commitment. So it's sort of all along the way asking myself if I was doing the right thing. And I think that it turned out okay, but during, when you're in the middle of it, it's scary. It's just a big, big, scary decision to make.
Going back really quickly to your undergrad or graduate, did you TA a lot when you were a student?
I TA'd for 1 year. My first year of my master's, I TA'd, and then all the other years I was a research assistant.
So I know you touched a little bit on how you got into research. What were the specific, like, step by steps that you took to kind of get into that and as an undergrad?
I was in the geography department. I was really interested in sort of just getting research experience because I didn't really know exactly what that meant, actually, like what was involved in it. And so I was looking for a faculty member that I could do research with and just get a better feel for like what that looked like and if I would enjoy doing that myself. And so I did a couple smaller projects, and both kind of related to snow. And you know, they weren't huge research experiences. They were little, but it was enough to give me an idea that I really liked the process of thinking about a problem, coming up with a way to sort of collect data to answer that problem, and then understanding if my initial thinking about it was correct or not, and that sort of the scientific method was, I had, you know, we learn about what that is, but I had never had to actually like put it in place, and I found that I really enjoyed that process, even on a very small scale, and that was enough, to motivate me to do my master's. But at each step, I was like, I'll do this and then see if I still like it. I didn't know when I went to go do my master's that I would do a PhD, or even though when I did a PhD that I would end up becoming a professor. I just sort of each step along the way, I was like, oh, I'll do a little bit more and see if I still like it. And then it kind of ended up with me doing research forever. But it was, yeah, so it was sort of a building block process, and not fully leaping in and knowing exactly what I wanted to do, the whole time.
There weren't any like programs like UROP or SRI that you kind of pursued. You like completely did it by yourself by reaching out to just a professor that you're interested in.
Yeah, I just reached out to them. I mean, I now work with Europe students, and I think it's a great program, but honestly, I don't think I knew it existed when I was an undergrad. I didn't know about those resources. And if I had known about them, maybe I would have been able to start a little bit sooner because I kind of fit in these research projects like in the last semester of my senior year, or like at the end, sort of as I was trying to figure out if going to grad school was the right thing. And so I wish I had known about those types of resources as an undergrad. But I don't know if that was, I was just kind of clueless, or if that information wasn't really like clearly provided to me. I can't remember. But now that I work with undergrads in those programs where they can be provided funding and opportunities to present their research to a larger audience, I think it's like an amazing program.
Yeah, I had a follow-up question, but I just barely forgot about it. So hopefully I can remember and I can come back to it.
Okay.
Okay, now I remember. So after you graduated from your undergrad, you went straight to your master's. No gap, is that right? Did you ever consider doing a gap year and like working independently?
I did consider it, I guess not very seriously because I didn't end up doing it. I did between my undergraduate and graduate for the summer, worked as a GIS analyst for the Utah Department of Transportation. And it was really more like an internship. And I'm glad I did it because, you know, that was always an option that I had gotten a GIS certificate and I had these mapping skills that if I didn't end up liking research, I could always go the route of getting a job in GIS and mapping. And so I'm glad I spent my summer doing that. And that helped me realize that that wasn't really where my passion was. I wasn't that excited about the work. And so that really helped motivate me going into grad school as being more interested in research.
Thank you. And so you mentioned that when you went to your PhD in UCLA, you knew that you wanted to come back to Utah. What was it? Was it like the research that you had done in your master's and your undergrad that you really enjoyed, and like the snow in the mountains that you wanted to come back to, or was there like another reason?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I love Salt Lake City for a lot of reasons. I think it's a kind of a special place. I was open to going anywhere with mountains, so I think that like being nearby mountains was important to me. And getting a professor job can be really challenging. You don't know exactly where you're going to end up, so I had like sort of dreamed of coming back to the University of Utah, but was open to going other places. But I think here we just in Salt Lake, there's you can get up into the mountains really quickly, but you can also get down to the desert, and there's just so many cool landscapes and outdoor opportunities so close to the city that I think it's Salt Lake is probably like one of the best places to live in the Western US. And I've only lived in Alaska and the Western US, so I guess I can't really speak to other places, but I think in terms of what you can access and the size of the city, I mean, there's just so many good things about Salt Lake. And so I had always hoped to come back here, even if I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to get a job here.
At any point, were you swayed during your PhD to stay in Southern California?
No. I worked, I did finish my PhD and worked at NASA JPL as a postdoctoral researcher for a year. So I ended up staying in Southern California for 5 years total. And I really liked the research that I was doing at JPL, but I didn't love living in Southern California. And now it's not a bad place. It just wasn't my favorite place. And so I actually, when I realized that I didn't want to stay there and make my career there, I was looking for other opportunities. And I actually I took a job as a professor at Utah Valley University for a year before getting hired at the University of Utah. So I was looking to get back to Utah or somewhere in the Intermountain West, and just got that UVU job first before the U of U one opened.
Do you see yourself staying in Utah for like the remainder of your career and the rest of your life, or do you ever see yourself picking up and moving someplace else, like Nordic European countries with more other snow and desert kind of areas?
That's such a good question. I would happily stay here, I think. But I also would be open to other opportunities going elsewhere. And it's hard to say like what those opportunities would be, but I'm not opposed to to moving or changing up what I'm doing, but I'm also quite happy where I am. And so the answer to that is, I guess we'll see what the future holds. But I do think that just to kind of come back to being a woman in this field, is I do think that women in academia are generally underpaid. And I think that women at the University of Utah, and specifically in my department, are also slightly underpaid. And so, if I'm being totally honest, if an opportunity came up where I felt like I could make the amount of money that I think I should be making, that would probably motivate me to leave.
I guess kind of going off of that, what sort of differences did you see in institutions comparing the University of Utah and UCLA of like of treating women in STEM and women in research?
Yeah, I think that it's a good question. I think I don't have much direct experience, so it's hard to speak to other universities and their policies and how they impact women in science. But just broadly, generally, I think that in STEM and especially in earth science, women are undervalued and underpaid. They're expected to do more for less, and they're always offered less money at the start. And there's, you know, numerous reasons people will point out for that, but none of them are fair. And so that wage gap between men and women scientists and researchers is a problem that I would love to see get addressed, and would probably allow for more women staying in science, because so many want to be scientists and end up getting pushed out of the field of science. And if they were getting paid the same as their colleagues or treated the same as their colleagues, it's much more likely that they would stay in science.
And so, you know, the recent bill HB 60 has that impacted sort of DEI and EDI efforts in academic institutions. How have you seen that sort of change women in STEM and women in research since that's been in place?
Yeah, that was disappointing to see, because I think it, you know, I think there's been broadly sort of a backlash against DEI efforts, but particularly in sort of more red states, and like Utah. And, you know, I think that a lot of times it has to do with the fact that people feel these inequities in academia and more broadly, and it's not just women, it's everyone who's not a white male feels like they aren't getting treated equally. And that has so many reasons and so much sort of historic precedence behind it. And there was, you know, some small amount of progress being made to not really addressing it, but at least talking about how it could be addressed and in sort of explicit terms. You know, you know, increasing diversity, how do we make people feel welcome? How do we recognize that people are coming from different backgrounds and that that's okay? That everyone sort of starts in a different place and brings different life experiences with them. And now that you're kind of restricted in how you're allowed to use that language and how we're allowed to talk about making people feel welcome and increasing, you know, differences across research and valuing diversity. It's I think we've taken a step backwards. You know, there's no perfect way to, you know, change this overnight, but the best way to make changes are to be able to talk about them, and to sort of be reined in on the way we're allowed to, you know, label things or talk about things is a limitation and a step backwards.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Okay, but I guess moving more onto like your personal passions. So how did you become passionate about, you know, the field that you were working in? And then do you still feel the same level of passion for your work as when you started, or has it changed?
Yeah, my first field season was when I was a master's student, and I got to go to Colorado and do multiple field trips to Colorado to this area where we were studying snow. And it was a field site that my graduate advisor had gotten set up through a grant before I started graduate school. But so it was nice because there was a, you know, sort of a set study area. And we got to go back multiple times over this one winter. And I was studying dust on snow, and that winter ended up being a pretty dusty winter. And so we got to watch dust get deposited. We got to see it in the snowpack. And then I got to study the impacts of that. And being able to see it and experience it really is what got me kind of hooked on it. And I think, you know, I'm really fortunate to be able to do field work in what I do, because seeing what you study really helps you understand it later when you're just working on it, modeling it, or looking at it from satellites, where it's not as sort of direct. Like, I just like to be able to feel and like understand the things that I'm working on, and that being able to do field work that first season, that's really just got me passionate about snow science and snow hydrology. And I was just amazed that I was getting paid to do that work, to like ski around and dig snow pits and collect snow samples. And I think that first year, I was just like so excited about it that I was like, okay, well, this is enough to motivate me then to get my PhD. That's like, goes back to like building blocks, like one step right after the other. And I was like, even if I don't end up doing this forever, if I get to do it for another 4 years in my PhD, then I'll be pretty happy about it. And so that's what got me passionate about it in the first place. And then seeing the impact that it had, my first couple of peer-reviewed publications, getting cited by people and talked about by people, that kind of kept me excited about the work. It was really well received, and that was really motivating. And then I would say, like, after that, the sort of, whether how excited I felt about the research would kind of go in waves a little bit. After you work on something for, I started graduate school in 2008, and so 15 years of doing similar research, you get tired of it sometimes. But luckily I have been able to expand out and research sort of broader topics around snow hydrology, and not just focus on dust on snow. I maintain that part of my research, but I've been able to sort of broaden out and more generally just focus on how much water is held in the mountain snowpack and how do we observe that and model it. And that has kept things interesting and allowed me to sort of, if I get curious about something, I know I can go and explore it. And that keeps me motivated, seeing something I get interested in and then spending time working on that. And then as I get motivated about that, then something new kind of happens with dust on snow or snow darkening, and then I get to come back to that. And so I think as my career has advanced, being able to work on different topics that I'm interested in just broadly keeps me motivated for keeping working on snow hydrology more broadly.
And then were there any other factors that kind of excited you to open up your own lab, or that kind of drove you to open your own lab?
Yeah, being a graduate advisor and sort of running a lab, it's a lot of work, but it's probably my favorite part of what I do, is advising new scientists and new snow hydrologists and watching them get interested in topics, and then becoming more independent researchers. I can kind of help them start on their own path, but then they really sort of take it on themselves and become more independent. And that is such an exciting process to watch, students sort of gaining their own, just sort of, yeah, how they feel, and they get excited about it and they want to take it on to become more independent, and just feel motivated to spend more time working on these topics without me telling them they have to do it. That is just a really cool process. And so I think I didn't necessarily know that when I started getting research grants and funding graduate students, but over the last 7 years that I've been at the University of Utah, that's really become sort of a favorite part of my position.
And so what does your work look like on a day-to-day basis? Just to like tell us about your, like, what you do and the people you interact with.
Sure. So now it's funny because in a last question, I talked about how much I love research, or getting out and doing like field work as a part of my research. And unfortunately I don't get to do that as much anymore. My graduate students do a lot of the field work now. So day to day, I have become a little bit more of sort of an administrator and manager of a research lab. So my job is to make sure that I'm applying for research grants and bringing in money to fund new students and to fund their fieldwork and fund the instrumentation we need to do the fieldwork that we need to do. So it's funny because I've sort of morphed into more of like a science advisor than the one who's actually implementing and doing the science. That's the graduate students that are really doing the science, which is great, but it's funny to see this evolution from being so excited about doing science to sort of now getting other people to be excited to do science and then just making sure that they're funded to do it. And so that takes quite a bit of time, finding research funding, applying for it, and then managing projects to make sure that you do what you say you're gonna do with that pot of money. And then of course, on top of that, I'm teaching classes as well. So sort of research and teaching and then other duties that you have to the department, sort of serving on committees and stuff. And it's sort of a split between all of these things. And so day to day, honestly, looks a little bit boring. It's a lot of time on my computer answering emails, I have a relatively large research group. I have 7 graduate students and 4 postdoctoral researchers. So being able to work with them and get updates on their research and then help them publish papers, that's exciting. And that's the best part of my job.
What's been your favorite research project? And that can be one that you've done in the past or one of your current graduate or postdoc students' projects.
You're asking me to pick a favorite project. Well, first I'll say all of the projects are great. But I think we've been able to, you know, a lot of my research, graduate research, was focused on looking at the impacts of dust on snow and snow darkening in Colorado and the upper Colorado River Basin. And when I came to the University of Utah, I mean, of course, when I was a graduate student here, I knew that dust was also deposited on the snow in the Wasatch. But when I actually came as faculty here, I remember looking out the window one day and watching dust blow off of the dry lake bed of the Great Salt Lake. And I was like, I wonder how much dust is coming from the dry lake bed, because we knew the lake was shrinking. And sort of did an initial study on that, just trying to get a handle on if dust was depositing on snow from the dry lake bed of the Great Salt Lake. And then I was able to get funding based upon that study and fund a graduate student to, you know, really dig in and spend a lot of time looking at dust in the Wasatch and the relationships to the dry lake bed of the Great Salt Lake. And it has just been that project, being able to do research sort of here in our backyard and understand the system that we live in, has just been really, that's been exciting. And I think useful for understanding and contributing to, you know, more broadly, people are really worried about the Great Salt Lake, and to be able to be doing research that's contributing to that and our understanding of that has been impactful and meaningful. So I'll pick that as my favorite project recently.
That's a good choice. And kind of building off of that, what direction do you want to take your students' research, or like in the future? Or do you have additional research projects in mind?
Yeah, one aspect of my research lab or group that's really been growing recently is developing snowmelt models that can be implemented operationally to improve the way that we forecast snowmelt for end users. So that could be someone who's managing a reservoir or a land user who needs water for agriculture. You know, 80% of our water comes from snowmelt. So being able to know when and how fast that snow is going to melt makes a huge difference for water users downstream. And so, you know, one of the motivations for developing these models is to account for the impacts of dust on snow, but just more broadly to be able to integrate all these great data sources that we have to give us a really accurate picture of how much snow is in the mountains and when it's going to melt. And that is also very impactful research and has been growing really quickly. And we're working with operational stakeholders like the Colorado Basin River Forecast Center to actually implement our research into their operations and sort of make a real world difference about how snow melt is being modeled. And that has a lot of potential for growth. And I'm excited to see where we're able to take that, where we're able to take that research.
And do you think that that has applications? Well, of course it has applications to any place that has snow, but where do you think that there are different impacts or relationships between dust and snow in different climates or in different geographies?
Yeah, great question. There is, and my work really focuses on mid-latitude mountains, and those mountains tend to be nearby dust-producing regions or large populations that emit a lot of pollution. So that can be dust, or it can also be like soot or black carbon, just sort of stuff that makes snow dirty. But I've been really fortunate to be able to study snow darkening all over the world, including in Greenland and Antarctica. And there, it's not really worried about like this season's snow melt, but more worried about long-term climate impacts of, you know, they get less deposition, snow is cleaner, but over time it's accumulating and it's staying there because it's ice. So it's not melting out every season. And so it's more thinking on these really long-term sort of climactic scales rather than seasonal hydrology scales. And so looking at mountains versus glaciers versus ice sheets is really interesting. And that's probably also something that keeps me motivated about this research, is just being able to work in different geographies, different places, and where these processes are related, but a little bit different.
So are there other labs at the University of Utah that are similar in the kind of field that you're pursuing with your research?
There are other people that work on snow and ice, glaciers, in different ways. Some are more focused on sort of the hydrology. Some are more focused on climate or snowfall. There's people in the atmospheric science department that are really interested in how snow falls and what controls that processes. So it's interesting to see how other people are looking at snow and ice and the way that they're thinking about it and researching it. And a lot of that work is very complementary to the work that my lab does. And so I feel fortunate to be at the University of Utah, where, you know, there's a lot of people that think about sort of cold region hydrology or cold region processes, and have people to collaborate with.
And so, yeah, I was just about to ask, does your lab collaborate with those other labs and like co-write papers or co-author papers?
Yeah, we do. We have, I have collaborated quite a bit with people in the atmospheric science department. And then there's also in the geography department, a glaciologist and an ice sheet scientist. So it's great to have people in my own department to even not, you know, maybe not write papers with, but just to talk about snow and ice stuff with, and then graduate students within our faculty group can collaborate and work with each other. And then I also have a close colleague in civil and environmental engineering. So that's like a little bit more applied snow hydrology, seasonal snow hydrology, mountain snow hydrology, but it's really complementary to the work that we do. And we end up getting funded projects together and get to work on sort of that snow melt model work that I was talking about.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. That's excellent. So does your funding, where do you apply for the majority of your research grants? Is it from the NIH or the NSF?
NSF is one place where we get funding. And then I do a lot of satellite remote sensing work. So I get project funding from NASA. And then for sort of more applied snow modeling work, a lot of that comes from NOAA. And then some other agencies that I've been funded through are like the Department of Energy, which has an Office of Science. Or the Bureau of Reclamation, which has a snow program to better understand snow melt, and also through the Army, who looks for sort of information if they have to do military-related work in cold environments. They sort of look for information about tools that they can use to better work within those sort of cold region areas, and so a lot of different, sort of a variety of funding sources. Basically, anyone who's willing to fund snow research, I will ask them for funding.
Sorry, did you? Oh, sorry. So I guess circling back to your NASA Caltech JPL experience, what was the most valuable thing that you learned from that experience? And circling back to, your experience as a woman in STEM, how was that experience any different from when you had worked as a researcher in undergrad and graduate school? And was there any experiences that stood out to you in your history?
I think I was fortunate to work with a team that was really great. We were working on this project called the Airborne Snow Observatory, which is basically a plane that flies over mountains and maps how much snow is there using LIDAR. And I just everyone on the team was really great to work with. But within the broader group that we were in at GPL, it was there weren't many other people working on snow, and it was also very male dominated. So I think one impact that that had on me is that I just couldn't foresee myself staying there to work there and make it my career. I didn't sort of see myself working permanently in that environment. And maybe if I had been able to envision that, then living in Southern California wouldn't have been such a hurdle. But the fact that I couldn't see myself working there forever, and I also didn't absolutely love living in Southern California, I think those two factors combined motivated me to look elsewhere to continue my research.
So would you say it was kind of a challenge finding a community that you felt supported in, given like that you're a minority in a male dominated field and there's just kind of lacking support in there, that area?
I think it's like one of the things that makes, people want to stay in a place is that they feel, supported and welcome, and that they can see themselves advancing. Like they see areas of opportunities sort of grow and learn. And I don't know that I saw that there. So yeah, it was probably broadly just the lack of support, and whether that's perceived or real, I don't want to say it like it was a terrible place to work because it wasn't, but I just couldn't envision myself being supported and staying there. And I think it probably did have a lot to do with the fact that it was mostly males that worked there.
Right. And I guess like personal anecdote for me, my dad worked at JPL from
Oh.
1990 to 2000. Yeah, he was an engineer, so not doing research. He was more on the technical side. And I remember he was always saying that it was a great place for women to work, but he never really mentioned any having any female coworkers. He did know one engineer though who became a senior manager, I think. And so I don't know, maybe it's him imprinting on me, but or following in footsteps. But going to JPL is also like a dream end goal of mine, working in the aerospace industry. So do you think that there, so obviously I think there's been a rise in kind of policies for like Inclusion Week and highlighting diversity and strengthen differences in perspectives and backgrounds. Do you think that kind of sort of same, like this same support was available when you worked there? So like less in like person focused and more of like systemic kind of encouragement?
Yeah, I think, I think there could be a difference here between, because I was a postdoc through Caltech, but I worked at GPL. And so I think that led to a little bit of a difference between like, maybe programs or support or mentoring that they would provide to employees of GPL versus postdoctoral researchers that are technically like funded through Caltech, but just working on site at GPL. And, you know, in general, I think postdoctoral research is a bigger problem within academia because those are temporary positions and there's a lot of expectations on postdocs and generally lack of support. That's not just a Caltech JPL problem. That's a whole academia problem. And so if I had stayed at JPL, maybe I would have found mentors and those and resources that they had that would have made me feel supported and included. But I think in order to reach that point, I would have had to have felt that way during my postdoc. So maybe there's like a gap in between permanent positions and postdoctoral positions that needs to get addressed more broadly across academia. And, you know, I do think, so let's see, I left JPL in 2015. And since then, the group that I used to be a part of has hired more females. It's just like a few more. And so maybe if I was there now, it would feel different and feel like more of a community for me rather than just like a place that I worked. Because I think that's so important that you have a community. And honestly, all of the engineers that I worked with at GPL all loved their jobs. So if that's the direction you're going, then I think you'll have a great experience.
That's the hope. So I guess kind of like expanding on that and applying it to the U of U, one of my previous jobs at the business school was working for the Office of Student Engagement and Belonging. So I saw a lot of the back-end support that was given to sort of empowerment programs and EDI before the bill was passed. Do you think that those programs are on the same level of accessibility to people in research than as they are to like staff of the university? And if so, why? And if not, what are the differences?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know, I guess I don't know that I have a good answer for it. I do think that there are really good intentions of making programs to offer resources to people and make them feel like they belong here, especially sort of first generation students or people from different backgrounds. But, I think if we look at the numbers of the University of Utah, it's predominantly white and not very diverse. So I think there is a long way to go between, sort of where we're at now and where we would like to be. And there are definitely programs, but whether or not those programs get advertised to the people who really need them, I think is potentially a gap that more work could go into. So I think the resources exist. I think people or students, scientists, knowing that those resources exist, hearing about them and then feeling comfortable accessing them, I think that there's probably more work to be done on that side.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, let me see. Some of our questions are about UCLA. Oh, so I stalked your LinkedIn for a little bit. And so I saw that you were applying to be a nominated position in, what was it?
It was, it's the AG, it's the American Geophysical Union Cryosphere Section President, which is a lot of words for a position, but yeah.
Yes, yeah. What inspired you to apply for that and how did you first come to know about it?
I first came to know about it because I have been involved, or basically the American Geophysical Union, they have a conference every year, and that's the main conference that I go and present my research at. And sorry. I became involved in the executive leadership team as a student, as sort of the student representative on it. And I really enjoyed my experience of getting to see how decisions were made, and also enjoyed seeing how things could be improved, or I had thoughts about things that maybe weren't being done as well as they could be. And I also, you know, that the cryosphere section, which is everyone that studies snow and ice, has actually been very supportive of getting more women into leadership positions, but that hasn't necessarily included women in snow. It's been more women who study glaciers or ice sheets. And so I wanted to apply for that position, and I don't know if I will get elected to it or not, but I wanted to apply for that position because I just haven't seen another woman who studies snow in that role. And I thought if I could get into that role, that then that will sort of break down a barrier for more women in my sort of subfield to also go after positions like that, because I just don't think until you see someone that looks like yourself in a position that it's hard to envision yourself in that position. And so I thought I would give it a try. And I don't know if I will get elected, but I think it's worth trying. And if I don't get elected this year, then maybe I'll try again the next time it comes up.
When do you hear the results back about the election?
I should hear next week. I think they said by the 8th of November.
Nice. Okay, right on. I guess this is, I know you kind of already touched on this, but if you are elected and put into that position, what sort of policies would you want to implement and kind of change would you like to drive?
Yeah, one of the changes that I would like to drive, well, I said that they've been really good at electing women into leadership positions in that role. Something that they've been less good at is giving awards to women. And there's a couple different awards that get awarded each year. And that can be for an early career person or a mid-career person or sort of later stage career people. And there, a couple years ago, was this, during the nomination process for sort of the later career award, not a single female was nominated for the award, despite the fact that there were, you know, plenty of women worthy of receiving the award. And so I think the main thing that I would like to address is just equity in who gets nominated and receives awards. So it's finding a way or thinking creatively of motivating people to nominate women in the first place. So at least there's an sort of an even number of applicants to consider for receiving awards. And then I think that's like the main thing I would like to work on. And then also just more broadly, this is like a little selfish, but more broadly representing snow within these fields of glaciers and ice sheets and areas of sort of snow and ice that get more attention. Like I think snow hydrology is so critical. This is our water source in so many places across the globe. And so just making sure that snow hydrology gets recognized and sort of the same amount of resources as these other fields.
Okay, and then how do you see your day-to-day changing if you're elected into that position?
It will probably be, I probably have a lot more meetings to go to sort of handle that position and meet with people in that role. So I think I would probably have to shift a little bit of my time from my current research program to put energy into that role and do it well. So it probably looks like scaling back a little bit on the number of projects that I have or number of graduate students that I have. And I think that's a fine trade-off if I'm able to make sort of headways or progress the progress that I would like to make in that role.
Great. And so more, I guess, about the process of that, is it sort of like a termed kind of position? Is it every like couple of years that they re-elect a new person?
Yeah, the way it works is it's actually it's kind of a time commitment because you get elected as a president-elect and you are in that position for a whole year and you're working alongside the current president. And so you're just a president-elect and then they move out of their president position and become past presidents. And then you become president for 2 years. And in your second year, that's when you're working with a new person that got elected. They're the president-elect. But then after your 2 years as president, then you become past president. So it's actually like, it's like a 4 year, ultimately ends up being sort of like 4 years being in some aspect of that role, but only 2 of those years are you actually acting as president.
Gotcha. Okay. Right, let me see. Oh, I guess, so what do you know about your opponent who's also running for the presidency? And then what kind of policies are they planning to implement?
You know, it's funny because they don't give you much space to like describe what you want to do. It's kind of like a little bit limited, the amount of information that you're allowed to put out there about yourself and the policies that you want to implement. It's kind of like a template you get to fill out. So I'm not exactly sure, but he is, it's a male and he's a glaciologist. And so we'll see. There's, you know, tends to be within the broader field of snow and ice, more people that study glaciers than study snow. So we'll see if all the glacier people come out and vote, and if they do, then he might get elected. But I'm sure that he would also do a great job because he's been involved just as I have, as sort of a participant in this executive committee, not yet in a leadership role, but both of us have been involved. And so I think whoever gets elected will end up doing a great job.
Let's see. So if not elected, do you have future aspirations to apply for another position apart from the presidency?
I would definitely consider applying. The American Geophysical Union, I think that they are like play a very important role in advocating for earth science. More broadly, they do earth and space science. And so as an organization, they just play a really important role of bringing people together and advocating, like literally going to, you know, Capitol Hill and making sure that earth science stays well funded. And so I think the organization is great. And I think it's something that I would like to be involved in. And so even if I don't win this first election, then looking for other ways that I can contribute to the organization and volunteer my time, I think is time well spent.
And so how involved are your graduate students and postdocs involved in the AGU? Is that something that you kind of pass along to them, that you kind of recommend and encourage them to participate in?
Yeah, exactly. We go, as a graduate student in my lab, you present your research at AGU every year. And so it's a nice chance to network and meet other colleagues in person and get a chance at sort of presenting and talking about your research. And I think it's a really valuable experience for all of my students every year. Just there's just something to be said about meeting and talking to people in person and learning, the way people are doing things either similarly or differently and sort of the new research that's out there. And it's just a really valuable experience, especially as a student.
See. So kind of like going on to future ambitions, where do you see yourself in like 5, 10, 15 years, still teaching and researching? I know you still really love Salt Lake City, so maybe same location, different location.
Yeah, I think, you never know exactly what's going to be happening, but I would love to still be teaching and researching, 5 or 10 years from now. I think as you sort of advance in your career, you do tend to end up taking on more roles, like leadership roles, like this one that I'm going for right now with AGU, or taking on more sort of administrative positions. You know, like you end up being a graduate director, an undergraduate director, or a department chair. You sort of move into these more administrative roles. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, what that looks like. Right now, I'm still really invested in growing and building my research program. So that's like where a lot of my energy lies and where I'm still, you know, very motivated and excited about. And so I would be a little bit sad to see some of that go away, to take on more of an administrative role, but that feeling might shift in the future. And I might be excited to take on more of like a leadership or administrative role within the university. But for now, I'm really invested in my research program and sort of keeping it growing.
So about teaching, so do you teach every semester, and how do you choose the classes that you teach? Is that something that you post to the department, something that you're really passionate about, or is that kind of a need from the department?
I think both, it goes both ways. Let's see. When I first started, they kind of have maybe classes that they need filled. It's more of like, okay, these are the classes that we need taught, so you'll teach them. And that one, when you first start, it's a little bit more of them telling you what they think you're going to teach. But as you get further along, you get a little bit more say and sort of, I'm interested in teaching this. And as long as there's availability and enough faculty members to teach all the classes, you get a little more freedom, or at least that's been my experience, a little more freedom to teach classes as we're really interested in. And so the classes that I teach are focused around remote sensing and mapping. And the main class that I teach right now is called Geospatial Field Methods. And it doesn't have anything to do with snow, but it uses the same methods that we use to map snow. And that's just mapping with drones. And so we get to go out. I get to take students out in the field and they get to fly drones and do mapping projects with drones. And it's a popular class. I love teaching it. I hope students like taking it. And so I've really enjoyed teaching that class, but that was one I had to teach some other classes first before they let me teach that class that I really wanted to teach.
Well, thank you for that. And so what sort of systemic like biases and challenges do you see now have being a professor, like among the students that you might have experienced yourself? And has there been any change over the years?
Yeah, I think some that all women professors probably get is not being recognized the same as our male colleagues. And this is usually like, you know, small things like not being called Dr. Skiles or Professor Skiles, but being called Miss Skiles. And that I try not to let that bother me too much. But you just wish that students would just kind of not treat women and men professors differently. But, it's something that I just try to politely correct, or just say at the beginning of the semester, I prefer to be called Dr. or Professor Skiles, or just Mackenzie. Like, don't use either one of those. Just call me by my first name. And then also, I think the comfort level of people being willing to ask for help, or like trust that you can provide help, has been an interesting aspect of this that I didn't really expect. Like, I will sometimes have a male TA and students will ask the male TA for help before me. And they're like, oh, well, I just thought he would be able to help me. And I don't know if that's a perception of like, maybe they're asking him because they think that he has more time, but also I wonder if they're asking him because he's a male. I don't, you know, so it's like hard to, it's hard to like really understand where that's coming from. But I do feel like there is some, there's some differences in the way that female professors are treated by students, and not all students, but enough to, for it to be obvious to me that male and female professors are treated differently.
Right. Right. Well, I think that's all that we have time for today.
Okay.
But so would you be willing or available to schedule just one more of these sessions next week?
Sure. I know you guys were trying to like wrap up by a certain date.
That's okay. It's our professor's pretty, she's very flexible with deadlines. So that's something that I'm really grateful for. Yeah, but we can also talk to her about how we have, you know, something in motion, and we'll get the project completed.
When would work best for you? Or like I definitely, if we could schedule one in the next week, that would be ideal. We could do the same time next Friday or before then. Is there something you see on your calendar open now that we could just get on the books, just because emailing is an inefficient, like while we're on Zoom, we might as well.
Yeah. I think I will actually be, I mean, we could still do it on Zoom, but I'll actually be on campus next Friday. And this same time would work next Friday. And I would be able to do it in person or over Zoom, whatever you guys prefer.
We're in the library right now. We just rented a room. So if you prefer to do in person, we can completely do that. And we can figure out what works on that day as well.
Okay. Yeah. So why don't we just plan on that? I think that Fridays are the easiest for me because I kind of keep Friday afternoons open just for meetings that pop up and stuff. So that's the time frame that I have like most open on my calendar.
Okay, sweet. Yeah, I'll send another calendar invite for that. Yeah. But
Sorry. I was just gonna say, so that was most of our like career questions, I guess. So, and that was about like, that was over half of what we'd like to ask you. And so next time should be about the same length if that works for you, or shorter. So
okay, yeah, that works for me.
Are you tight on time right now? Or could I ask you like three follow-up questions I made a note of? Just while
it's no fresh. Yeah, you can ask me. I have something at 4, so I don't, it's not, I'm not tight on time.
Perfect. Yeah, I have just three questions. When we were talking earlier, you kind of mentioned you didn't want to ruffle feathers because you felt like you like kind of forced your way in. Do you think, is that like just the impression like other people made you feel like you were forced in, or do you think it's a little bit of imposter syndrome, like, oh, there's nobody else that's female, I jumped along? Or do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I think imposter syndrome is definitely a part of it, and it's something that I still have. Like, I don't always feel like I belong where I am, or that, you know, it's kind of hard not to have that as a woman in science, I think generally. And if a woman in science doesn't have it, then I'm jealous, and good for her. But, you know, I think it's funny because when I say like force my way in, I literally had to say to people, you're not inviting women, you're excluding women from fieldwork opportunities. I need to be invited. And so, or saying like a field, some sort of, you know, group fieldwork event had happened and I hadn't been invited. And then I'd have to go up to whoever, you know, organize and say, you only invited men. Like, that's not fair. And so, or just saying, even if it was like, say a chance to present at a conference or go to a conference or something, I would have to, you know, sometimes find my own funding or just ask people to remind them that there are women that also do this work and to make sure that they feel included. And so to me, it very much felt like just kind of like, you know, I wanted people to be aware of it, but I also didn't want to be too pushy because I didn't want to be the annoying girl constantly like saying, oh, you're not including women, which is like not, it's, I should have been, I shouldn't have felt that way, because sometimes you just have to advocate for yourself. But that is where, you know, so it's sort of this like push and pull between, I want to advocate for myself, but I don't want people to be annoyed with me or think that I'm being pushy. So it's like, I want to be pushy without being perceived as being pushy. and so that was sort of, yeah, sort of the struggle that I dealt with.
That answers my next question actually too. And then I was just wondering, before I just did a paper kind of about the history of women in field work. And I was just wondering if you like experienced any harassment or heard stories about any other women?
Yes, both. I mean, I think the harassment, I mean, God forbid, I did not experience any sort of like direct sexual harassment, and that I have heard of women who were forced into positions that just should have never happened. The sort of harassment that I experienced was, were men saying very inappropriate things and just making me feel really uncomfortable. And one time a male colleague of my graduate advisor, you know, called him and said, I don't, you know, I, after I had gone on a field trip, he said it was distracting to have a female on the field trip, and I don't think that women should be a part of like field work that is all like mostly male. And I was just shocked. I was shocked that that, and my advisor was shocked too, that that had been said. And that I somehow, it was my fault that I like was, you know, as a female distracting the men that were doing field work. Like, it was just kind of like gross. I was like, not, but you know, I don't know. It was just, so that like kind of experience where, and then people just making like men making just like sexual jokes and stuff that you just don't feel comfortable. You don't feel like you belong. And like, it's just totally inappropriate. And that sort of stuff happened all the time. And just, yeah, so that was my experience, which compared to other women that I have talked to or interacted with that have actually either been assaulted or made to feel like they had to do something they didn't want to do. Like, luckily I've never been in that position. But I have felt extremely uncomfortable and that should never be the case for anyone doing field work.
Okay, sweet. Thank you. I think that's, I guess last question, very serious, just because it's an official record. You do work at Monte at Waterclaw. I was just wondering if you had a like specific ski line to get, you know, which peak around in the Little Cottonwood, you know, top of the canyon that you'd like to say is your favorite place to ski.
Yeah, that's a good question. I like Flagstaff a lot. And I think just like anywhere sort of, you know, Mount Superior still scares me a little bit, but I've done it a couple times and it's been really great. and basically, you know, anywhere in Little Cottonwood Canyon is amazing, but there's so much traffic that these days I end up usually going elsewhere. But yeah, I'll call out to Flagstaff as being great.
Well, that was my only two questions. So thank you. Is there anything?
Yeah, nothing to add on. But yeah, good to hear about the skiing.
All right, sweet. Thanks for meeting with us.
And yeah,
we'll see you so much next for your time. Friday.
Okay, I will see you guys next Friday.
Perfect. All right.
Send that invite.
Okay.
Thank you.
I hate ending Zooms.